This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, parody, farce, and exaggeration. Satire in speculative fiction.
So, I think before we properly begin, best course of action is to actually define what satire is. And Jules, of my understanding, you've been actually doing a fairly steady bit of research into that.
Yes. Well, it's one of those words where you're like, you hear it all the time, but unless you've actually studied it yourself, you assume you know what it means, and then someone says define it and you have a bit of a panic and think, do I actually know what it means? It turns out I did, but it's basically the use of humour, irony, exaggeration or farce to express and criticise people's stupidity or vices. And it's used a lot in the context of contemporary politics and, I suppose, other topical issues.
Yes. And the thing about satire is that it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because it sort of requires an understanding. Satire only works if you understand or have at least a basic knowledge of the thing which is being satirised.
Yeah,
otherwise,
absolutely.
The humour disappears.
You can't just go, oh, politics is bollocks, ha 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 ha, and not know what you're criticising. I mean, it might very well be true, but as you say, you have to have some understanding of it.
Bit of satire recently, for instance, was a comedian, and I cannot remember who, putting up on his Twitter, I have two Russian friends who are coming to visit, but they're only here for a couple of days. Where shall I suggest they go? And he listed things like London and Edinburgh, Bath and, I don't know, Norwich or something. And then just saying Salisbury and Salisbury.
Right.
Get it? Because of that recent, the Russian
the supposed attack on the, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it was the two Russian guys who suspected were like, no, we just went to Salisbury to see the cathedral. We came all the way to see the cathedral and then we went back to Russia.
So it's possible, but it's not likely. Yeah.
So satire basically requires an understanding of the thing which is being satirised. It's often been used to actually discuss, particularly usually lefty, but not always, agendas. And it is rooted a lot in politics and morality as well.
Yeah.
But it isn't always political. Satire is also used to poke fun at things, at popular media, and things that other people enjoy. And you see that a lot in fiction. For instance, satire can, references are, can sometimes be a form of satire, but only if they're really sort of mocking it. Several times in Gravity Falls, there's an episode of Gravity Falls where Mabel, the main female girl character, has a band that she really likes who are called Several Times. And Several Times are very obviously a satire of a band like Westlife or the Backstreet Boys or things like that, to the point that these are the way they look, the way they sing, the way they dance, and the very comical way in which they're acted. Is an obvious satire. This isn't a political agenda. It's meant to draw on a, not an archetype, but on a model which we all recognise, which can then be mocked because of its popularity.
Yeah. Let's look then at the three main types of satire. And then obviously they've each got offshoots and people use them in different ways and they get combined. I suppose the thing is with satire is it's not just comedy. It's often used for comic effect, but you can have satire that's actually not very funny at all, and it's still satire. So probably the one most people are familiar with, even though they don't know this, is Horatian satire, which was named after the Roman satirist from 35 BC, Horace, strangely enough. His name was Horace. So I
That's
can't imagine
very
why they called
funny.
it Horatian. Anyway, yeah, it's the use
Because
of not.
Horace is not a
It's not a.
I'm not going to say anything in case any of our listeners are called Horace, but it's I find that name humorous.
Okay, well, comedy effect of the name aside, Horatian satire uses wry humour, wit, and generally light-hearted mockery. So it's the sort of thing most people would be familiar with. One of its trademarks is it tends to avoid the negativity of, but the negativity of the satire itself by refusing to place blame on anything or
Yeah.
anyone. And it focuses on highlighting human folly. So, for the most part, you'd be thinking of things like Terry Pratchett, for example, or you'd probably be looking at things like Blackadder, Red Dwarf, and, as you've said, that bit in Gravity Falls, you know, that parody of the typical boy band
Yeah.
being used. And it's not seeking to change it. It doesn't. It's not satire with an agenda. It might change someone's mind by gently pointing out a few things to them, but it's more about highlighting an issue than trying to get people on side, as it were.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the one that's easiest for most people to stomach because satire has claws, and a lot of people find it sort of a bit hard to take, I think,
Yeah.
unless they're quite cynical themselves. Then you have Juvenalian satire. Now, guess who Juvenalian satire was named after?
Couldn't possibly think.
It's another Roman satirist, Juvenal, from 1st century BCE.
I wonder if we get any other words from that at all.
I can't imagine. Yeah, this is not actually outright funny. It tends to have a strong component of rage or moral anger behind it, and it does seek to subvert the status quo. It tends to mock, well, it actually attacks probably the political class and or religious leaders, and it tends to attack individuals, government and organizations, and with much stronger doses of irony and sarcasm. So this isn't humor that's seeking to gently point out that things perhaps could do with changing. This is really often quite vicious type stuff.
Yeah. So it's the kind of things you might see columnists do, comics in newspapers, things along those lines.
Yeah, and you'd probably say things like spitting image, which you're too young to remember, probably, but that sort of thing. I grew up with spitting image. I wasn't really allowed to watch it, to be honest, probably because of those. And the third one is Menippean satire, which is named after a Greek philosopher called Menippus from the 3rd century BCE. Yeah, this tends to focus on an individual character flaw or personality trait. It does employ elements of Horatian satire, so the gentle mockery, but it's a bit more prickly and a bit more sarcastic, but it's very focused on one thing. So it's looking at a person's inherent flaw rather than a misdeed. So if you think of things like, it can be funny, it doesn't have to be funny, but if you think of things like Alice in Wonderland, all her misfortunes come about because she was too curious not to follow the White Rabbit. So the entire thing is a Menippean satire of her curiosity. But yes, it's any viewpoint which renders a human worthy of mockery and ridicule. So
So there we go.
those are our three main types.
So yeah, it's as you say, it's a very important thing to recognize that satire isn't necessarily funny, but I guess it defines what we mean by funny. Satire certainly isn't necessarily harmless, and it is actually, as we've said, a very, very political. Satire has been used historically for a very, very long time to demote public figures, to bring them down, to make them lose popularity, and also to sway actions and government through mockery.
Yeah, and it, as you said before, it relies heavily on wit and intelligence, and those are things that will win people over to your side in an argument.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose I was going to say we've all been, but possibly we haven't all been. We some of us have been the person who has deliberately, I'll say, attacked, verbally attacked somebody for good reason. And this person, oh yeah, I sound like I'm saying I'm asking for a friend when we all know I'm talking about myself here.
Just go ahead.
Yeah, so there have been instances, mostly in my teenage years, it's fair to say, where it was not one, it was one person engaging in bullying behaviour, and they were backed up by people who were following the strongest person in the room. And it's not that I have a problem with punching bullies, I obviously don't, but that's not what a good convent girl does. So I tended to take them down with words instead, and it's amazing how quickly people move over to your side if they find what you said funny. And they really don't want that wit directed at them. And even my mother said at one point, I think I was about 13, she said, "Well, you've always had a good line in put downs." And she had a point, because my outlook on the world at the time was to find somebody's weakness, the thing that they didn't really want anybody else to notice, notice it and store it away for future use in case I ever needed to. I'm not really like that anymore, by the way, but I used to be.
Always said you'd be a terrible enemy, Jules. I've read your bad reviews. Whew.
It's only if somebody writes something that offends me.
Still. But yeah, so a little bit of a history lesson, of course, is we've mentioned it before, but we look at the poets in Celtic times, and the fact that poets could make or break kings because of the way that they used words. This was another form of satire, and the idea that mockery could really have a tremendous effect on your popularity, to the point that poets, I don't think, were even allowed to marry because people, or to produce children, on account of the fact that people were afraid they'd just be too powerful if
Well, yeah, I mean, not, if you think about it, not everybody could read and write. Certainly not everybody had the time dedicated to learning huge bodies of law or learning to be, like the Skalds, for example, of Nordic tradition, whereby they were huge political players, and their ability to come up with songs and poems on the spot that sort of either satirized or portrayed someone in a flattering light was very highly valued. Yeah, it's not something that just anybody could have done. You had to be quite clever to do it. But as you said, they can make or break a kingdom in a lot of ways.
And we do definitely see that now in the press, and actually in the way that we use comedy. SNL, for instance. SNL often do parody pieces. And some of these are pretty political, especially the ones which are in which they act out and they mock political figures and the decisions that they've made. I think some of the famous ones are Donald Trump, for instance.
Is there a Donald Trump parody or meme that isn't funny ultimately? Because he's eminently mockable.
He is incredibly mockable. And so we have an example of satire being used here. In order to further really the other party's agenda by emphasizing and over-exaggerating and insinuating things about the president which aren't necessarily, well, which are exaggerated. Though, of course, with Donald Trump, I think sometimes some satirist writers and things like that, for instance, like the Daily Thump and God, the other one,
The Daily Mash,
the Daily
The
Mash,
Onion.
thank you, the Onion, yeah, that was it, the Onion, who are basically saying, look, we can't come up with stuff anymore because the r real life is just being too ridiculous. Real life is a satire of itself, and it kind of is when we think about The Simpsons and the satiristic things that they portrayed. like
Well, yeah,
Donald
like,
Trump becoming president.
and everyone's like, no, that's ridiculous. That's why it's funny. And then here we are, like 10 years later. It's like we're not laughing now.
Yeah, because that was definitely a satire of people's the people of America and Donald Trump at the time. And it's come true. So, I mean, in some ways we don't really need to exaggerate with certain figures because they kind of do it themselves. But we still do. And yeah, the idea, of course, is to apply that, even though we know that, okay, for instance, I'll give you one of the SNL sketches. You have Vladimir Putin who arrives and brings Donald Trump a doll, which is an elf on the shelf, which very clearly has a camera in it. And he says, "So you're just going to leave this out all year round? It's a game. You're just going to leave this out all year round, and you're just going to face it here towards your board meetings." And the joke is, of course, he's like, "Ha ha, yeah, of course, absolutely." And you see nothing wrong. And obviously, I mean, I really bloody well hope it isn't true. It's an exaggeration of the fact of a common kind of understanding that we have that Russia is involved with the
Yes.
president. But it's an exaggeration to the point that we almost see the involvement of Russia on that next level, as in we're almost willing to believe he would be that stupid. And it the, these this emphasis does have a very hard political agenda in discrediting someone who really don't, you don't need to work that hard to discredit, if we're honest.
No.
Like, I sound like I'm defending him. Like, I'm not. He deserves this. He's a terrible human being. I mean that with all my heart and soul. He is a terrible human being. But it's one way in which satire is so powerful.
Yeah, definitely. Let's look at some of the techniques of satire, because I think some of these bear looking at.
Okay.
So we've talked about exaggeration. Yeah. Again, it can be exaggerating a characteristic, it can be exaggerating a whole person, or it can be exaggerating a situation.
Yeah.
Something that does this really well, in my opinion, are things like Blackadder and Red Dwarf. Blackadder, the things that. I mean, Blackadder employs all elements of satire, and it's one that's aged really, really well, in my
Yeah.
opinion. So it's accessible for new generations, not just people who, came in on the tail end of it or grew up with it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think it shaped an entire generation's sense of humour, it would be fair to say.
I think it really did. Though it does also, I think it is quite timeless, but at the same time, it has aged a little bit. I was watching an episode of it the other day, and sort of, I'm not going to say sensibilities because that's the wrong word, but there have been changes. I mean, some of the things which are mocked.
Well, yes, I mean, if you look at that Black Hat, the Blackadder Bells from the second season,
Yeah.
Blackadder the Second, where he's in love with his manservant, who isn't actually a man, and he's
Yeah.
talking to the alchemist about it, and the alchemist saying, well, the fact that you're a screaming bender with no more right to live on God's green earth than a weasel, I mean, it's clearly that's not what they actually mean, but the way that you wouldn't probably write something in quite that way anymore. But back
Yeah.
then, you would write it that way because it was kind of a take back thing. I mean, they knew you had a gay actor actually on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. There's things like incongruity. And so when you put two elements together that really don't sit together, and it can sort of then lead into things like surrealism, like Monty Python does, for example,
Yes.
which is another good one. Reversal. Reversal is where you take something how it should be or how we understand it to be in life and you change it around. So, simplest example would be episode of Blackadder whereby you've got a female character. In fact, a good one is Queenie from Blackadder
Yeah.
because we know Elizabeth I was incredibly intelligent and possibly the best monarch we've ever had, and yet she plays her like a spoiled little girl who really doesn't have much of a clue what's going on and is just flirting with everyone all the time. So she's taken a tiny, tiny element of the character of the original historical figure and exaggerated it until it eclipses everything else, and it is complete reversal. And things like double entendre, I think we all know what that is. So that's when you're into things like, I suppose, I find that can be a bit sort of lowbrow humour wise, but it can work as well. You need to consider obviously tone for your audience. So what are you really trying to say?
Yeah. Well, can you give an example, a good example of it being used?
Of tone?
Of the double entendre.
Double entendre, not off the top of my head, no. But I'm sure you can think of something generally people use. For example, using plumbing to describe a sexual situation, but they're actually talking about a real plumber.
Yeah, of
Except that someone listening in and hears it and hears fix your cistern to mean something completely different to actually fixing your cistern, for example.
Fix your cistern. Who the hell would...
Well, just off the top, if you were talking to an actual plumber, you might say that, but someone else is like, oh, they're in there sort of girl talking, and they're actually talking about a plumber kind of thing. Yeah, along with the exaggeration, there's the burlesque. So in the sense of a really, really exaggerated gesture to bring the audience on board with you, you're kind of breaking the fourth wall there.
Yeah.
I didn't know this had a term. This is great. Zergruer.
Ooh, okay.
It's a figure of speech which applies to two other items within that speech, but in different senses. So, for example, if you were to come in to the library with a book and hand it to me and say, I've expired,
you could be
talking about the book, or you could be saying, I've just died on you. I mean, that's not a very funny example, but... But, you know, that is that sort of idea.
It could be a funny example.
It could be a very funny example, but, you know. And parody. Parody is actually, in some ways, my least favourite form of satire and comedy, because I've seen too many books that are supposed to parody another book, and what they actually do is a weak knockoff copy, and it's not clever or witty at all. But there are exceptions to that rule, and... There's one I'm thinking of by C.L. Lynch called Chemistry, and it's a parody of Twilight.
Yeah.
And it's really intelligently done. It's very funny. Instead of being, you know, the quiet, gentle Bella Swan who's small and pretty and doesn't realise she's pretty, etc., etc., you've got loud plus side, very sweary Stella Blunt who really just says exactly what she thinks. And instead of Edward, you've got you've got Howard instead of Edward. Howard's actually a zombie, so he's like the least sexy of all the supernatural creatures. And the whole thing is extremely funny, and it's an extremely well done parody, and it sort of punctures a lot of, you know, inflated YA tropes. So, as I said, parody is my least favourite, but when somebody does it right, it's really good.
Okay. Yeah. We do get a lot of some very good examples of parody done well. Is actually abridged series that you get usually of anime. Have you ever watched any of the abridged, like Dragon Ball Z abridged?
No.
Yu-Gi-Oh abridged. They're hilarious. I mean, the odd thing is the first few episodes you kind of have to get into it, and they're sort of a little bit funny, and then they just build up this entire world of inside jokes.
Yeah.
And it just becomes sort of pant-wettingly funny. Even if you only vaguely know who the characters are, and it works especially well with anime, because especially some of the old anime, because you kind of know who the characters are supposed to be because they're sort of archetypes, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So in the way that they're being parodied, you already know what they're parodying. For instance, you've got I can't even remember a name in Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged, who's always going on about the importance of friendship. And it's hilarious because, and of course, it's a complete parody of the fact that the key message in these animes is always, and friendship. Friendship is the key to everything. And it's just really nicely done that it becomes almost this weapon that she has, where she, you know, she can lecture someone about friendship and literally kind of just make them fall into a coma or something like that.
Yeah.
And other things as well. And just very small lines, like the fact that in the Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged English version, Bakura happens to be played by a Brit, I think. I think he's got a British voice while everyone else is American.
Yeah.
And there's always this kind, he's also very effeminate and quite girly, and so there's this whole joke of him always saying, "I'm not gay, I'm just British." And then when he becomes evil, Bakura, he goes, "I'm not British, I'm just gay." And it's this endless kind of satire of on level after level after level, looking at both the series itself, and then further than that, it becomes quite meta in that it's not just the series and the storyline, it's the decisions that people who've made the series and storyline used in creating the original. So down to the voice acting, down to the censorship, like in the American version of Yu-Gi-Oh, they took out all the guns, so you just have all these guards and stuff like that, just pointing their fingers instead,
Yeah.
or something stupid like that. So they keep making sort of jokes about these invisible guns, or and it's really funny. The more you kind of watch it, and the more ridiculous it gets. And I think that's a very, very good version of parody, which draws on something quite old or outdated, and sort of presents it to a kind of a modern audience.
Have you ever watched Robot Chicken?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. For anyone who hasn't watched it, it is very funny. It's quite close to the knuckle a lot of the time. And the whole thing is almost a series of parodies of various bits of popular culture.
Yeah.
And I suppose it works for me because a lot of it comes from things, it's Seth Green. So he would have been of the same generation of me as me. So he uses bits from my childhood, like Rainbow Bright, which people are not going to remember, but I'm going to explain it Rainbow Bright, 80s kids program. Rainbow Bright brings colour to the universe, basically. She rides around on a magic horse who can gallop along the rainbow, and she uses star sprinkles mined by sprites in order to make sure everything is a per the perfect colour it's supposed to be. So they've got her being all happy, and I'm bringing colour to the universe in this particular parody. And then she comes in, goes into her room, kicks off her boots after a long day, and throws a Sprite in the microwave as a snack. The idea is that nobody is that sunny in age, but actually she's got the sprites kind of enslaved, and she eats their children. But as I said, it's quite close to the knuckle, but it is very funny.
I saw a parody of well, it was a parody both of A Christmas Carol and of Marvel's Tony Stark,
Yes.
in which he's refusing to they have to work over Christmas or something like that, and all the others are like, "Oh, but we had this whole thing, we're gonna cook this turkey and stuff like that." And so I think it's Deadpool takes Tony Stark back in time to sort of look at why he's so embittered about Christmas. And ultimately, what happens is that he comes to the right conclusion, goes, "No, we won't work during Christmas. We deserve this holiday." And then aliens attack and destroy the world, which is great. But there's just this one line in it where you've got Tony Stark outside of his house during a Christmas, meant to be looking at the Christmas of his past, and and you've got little baby Tony Stark saying to Howard Stark, "What do you think? What am I going to get in my stocking this year?" And Howard Stark just goes, "Well, not my love and approval, that's for sure."
Harsh.
And I was like, "Oh!"
It does. It really makes you. Sometimes it's so close that you kind of like it's. You get to the end of a sketch and it's like you almost can't laugh because it's that painful.
It is,
It is
yeah.
really. It is very much satire. The one I remember that does make me laugh is Conan the Barbarian the musical. Which, if you grew up seeing, and that was a big thing back in the 80s and 90s, Arnold Schwarzenegger films, but Conan the Barbarian, and it's like, Conan, what is best in life? And he just bursts into song. It's like, crush your enemies, crush your enemies. And it's hilarious. I think Alan and I were laughing at that so hard, we had to just keep winding it back so we could watch it again, so we could finally get to the end of the sketch without missing anything.
Brilliant.
So.
Well, I've been watching a series called Upstart Crow.
Okay. I've not
It's
heard of
by
it.
Okay, so it's by the same people who do Blackadder. Highly recommended. And it's basically a sit well, it's not a sitcom, but it's a series that follows Shakespeare. As he's coming into, making writing his first plays and sort of becoming the man that we know him to be today. And it's hilarious. If you love Blackadder, I really, really do recommend checking out Upstart Crow. Very similar kind of on the nose humor. And I really, really do like the way that they parody and they satire Shakespeare's plays within his life and within this sitcom, whilst also parodying and satirizing rather common tropes today. So for instance, like they keep talking about making reference to Brexit within the, but of course, it's sort of like in the olden days, and they keep also making references to the train lines and public services. In fact, every episode, what happens is that Shakespeare goes home to Stratford, and they always like, "How was your journey?" And he always says how miserable it was, and he describes these situations, which even though he's obviously talking about being on a coach, it's definitely a train situation, and you know that that's what he's describing. And so it's very, very funny, but probably one of my favorite tropes that they do is that obviously this is meant to be real life, not a play, but the characters will occasionally take a side and have a little monologue to themselves, and it almost always starts with them going, "Here, I shall stand aside and speak," which by convention means that no one else can hear what I'm saying. And it works. They just stand aside and then they start plotting aloud to the audience, except, but I really, really like that. And the fact that it's like, which by convention means no one can hear what I'm saying.
That's just awesome. That sounds so up my street. It should be called Julesville.
But I love that because not only is it satirizing these very common tropes in Shakespearean sort of literature and how we understand it, it's also satirizing the modern world. And I just think it's a really, really, really good series in that sense. So yeah, okay, I won't go on about it, but I think that's a just like Blackadder, here's an example of satire and parody being used successfully for both the sake of humor and also and also to help audiences actually feel more connected with the characters. So the fact that Shakespeare keeps coming in and talking about the fact that he bought a what is the equivalent of clearly a first class ticket, but then some youths just came by and just sat in it, and the ticket collector obviously didn't ask them to move, and very, very simple kind of things that you'd expect. It makes it feel very modern whilst also not being modern at all. And I think one of the plot points, for instance, is that Robert Greene, is constantly plotting against Shakespeare. And what he does is he starts to plant into the idea that sh into people's minds the idea that Shakespeare didn't write his own plays.
That's perfect.
And he basically gets his other the other lords who people have attested Shakespeare were actually really Shakespeare, he's just there like, yeah, so what I want you to do is I want you to just put little similar kind of things that Shakespeare uses, and they're like, well, obviously we're going to be doing that, we're both writing in the same language. He goes, exactly, and they're like, but there's no proof that we are Shakespeare. He's like, exactly, so everyone will believe it. And I really, really like that. I just thought it was a really, really good use of parody and of satire. Because satire can also get quite exhausting if you're watching it too much or reading it too much.
Yeah, it can be draining. You need some of the lighter forms of satire at least, and just comedy elements, I think, to keep you going. So I completely agree with that.
So yeah, so you should definitely watch it, Jules. I think you'll love it.
Yeah, I just hadn't heard of it, so that's cool. Is that on Netflix?
BBC iPlayer. The first series is on Netflix as well.
Cool. Okay, I'll have to check that out. I want to talk about Terry Pratchett. Because he is probably the greatest satirist to have lived in our sort of time, in our time frame. Okay, not everybody's a fan, not everybody's read his books, and not everybody's been able to get into them if they have tried. I have to admit, I started off as a teenager trying to read from the beginning, from basically his wizard books at the beginning of the Discworld series, and I ended up just being a bit sort of underwhelmed. And okay, obviously as a writer he developed as he wrote as he went on. I mean, the guy wrote more than he wrote about 80 books, I think.
Jesus.
So he was prolific in his lifetime. And but the wizard ones are really dry. I get that they're satire of bureaucracy. And I completely understand that, but there wasn't enough there to really draw me in. And it wasn't until I stopped trying to read his books in order, the Discworld books, that is, and started reading them as I fancied it in series within the Discworld, that I really got into it. And I wouldn't say that I could sit down and just read a whole bunch of them one after the other like I can with some things, because you're almost better off reading one and letting it sort of sink in. But he really does make me laugh. One of my favourites is Small Gods, which is funny. I think it uses all the elements of satirical technique and probably all three types of satire as well. And the whole thing is just this brilliant standalone novel that pokes holes into religious dogma. And you start off with Om. Now, in Discworld, gods get their powers from human belief. And when they start losing believers, they become less powerful. And they sort of downgrade in form. And Om has downgraded to the point where he's a tortoise. Om's not happy about this. He neglected his followers for too long, and people stopped believing in him, or really believing in him properly as he was, and he became a tortoise. And he finds himself stranded outside a desert, and just as he thinks he's trying to get somewhere, an eagle comes out of nowhere, swoops him up, and just carries him off. So Om's initiation into the human world is not great, and it's played on later and later. But he gets dropped by the startled eagle, drops him into the lap of a large, well-meaning but illiterate boy who's a young monk in the Omnian sect. And this boy is the only one who can actually hear him. And
Of course.
it just goes on from there as he tries to get his followers back, and this boy helps him. And on one level, it's a really lovely story because the god sort of learns that, all human lives have value, and perhaps things matter like kindness and morality, and perhaps it's not all about fire and sword and killing the infidels kind of thing. So by the time he gets to the point where he does actually reascend to his full glory, because everybody now believes in Om, he's rewritten the laws, and the laws include things like eagles must be driven off with arrows, there should always be lettuce available for the gods, but also things like, religion is a private matter and we shall keep it to ourselves. And it's just this really great reversal, and there's some hilarious lines in it as well, because he's picked the main character, the young monk, is the most unassuming and unlikely hero you can imagine. He's not even a reluctant hero because he doesn't know enough to be a reluctant hero. And yet he somehow comes through everything. He can't read, but he's got a photographic memory. So he can remember everything he sees. He just hasn't got a clue what it means. So when things like the Great Library with all the religious texts is burnt down, he can remember all of them.
Just can't be.
It's like can't be accessed, but he becomes kind of like the Dalai Lama, basically, of this religious sect. He becomes the high priest of Om.
Aww.
It's a really great story, and there's lots of that in Pratchett. I mean, you have ser I mean, this is like a standalone, and you have others where you have characters like Tiffany Aching or Moist von Lipwig or Vimes running in series, and they look at various different things. And what really strikes me is that in amongst the humour, there is this palpable sense of rage against how the world's set up. And that this, in some ways, is kind of Pratchett's way of processing that and saying, look at this, look at this, this is wrong. So again, we go from the Horatian satire to the Juvenilian satire.
I think the other thing to remember, of course, is that satire is also a way that people process grief.
Yes.
And actually, that's why satire and tragedy can sometimes be so closely linked together. We reflect again on Blackadder, for instance. Particularly, I think one of the most poignant Blackadders was Blackadder Goes Forth.
Yeah, the absolute final episode. And
Yeah.
yeah, they could have played it for laughs and they didn't.
They didn't. In fact, I think they tried to, and then they realized that they didn't really need to. And the fact of the matter is that, this is comedy which is taking place during the worst period in history. Well, I say the worst period in history, that's debatable. But during a very violent and very sad and very
Pointless.
pointless period of history where a lot of people died, including the characters that we all know and love. And this isn't the only example of satire taking place, satire being related to gallows humor, and satire taking place where the worst things are in life. I don't want to spoil anything for Upstart Crow, but the most recent episode had something similar happen to it, and as well, because of course there were some sad things which happened in Shakespeare's life. And these things do need to actually be discussed at some point. Another example is a series like Horrible Histories.
Yeah, I've never watched them, but obviously I've seen the books.
Yeah, and they are quite funny actually. And it is definitely at times it's definitely meant for a certain age. But it is informative and it is interesting. And it is funny. But it's also about, literally, as it says, horrible histories, the worst of people, the worst things that used to happen. So we're constantly talking about death, and inequality and other things like that. So there is this relationship between satire, and not horror, but satire and tragedy, because it actually satire is an excellent way to be able to deal with tragedy. We get other things, other forms of satire in stories which are about death. I mean, can you think of, comedy film? Well, we get it a lot in British comedy as well, where actually you have like Death at a Funeral, for instance. They did an American version of it, but I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist. Because seriously. But Death at a Funeral, very, very funny, small movie, which is literally what it sounds like. It's a man has died, his family are all trying to, prepare for his funeral, and the next thing they know, they discover that the man was lovers with a dwarf who arrives on scene and then is promptly killed, and then they have to get rid of his body whilst at this funeral. And it's hilarious. It's really, really funny. But at the end of the day, it's also about a family dealing with the loss of their father, dealing with social situations with one another, and also dealing with the idea that maybe they didn't really know their father at all. And
Yeah.
these are some really, really sad themes, which are made all the more poignant when they're combined with this humour. And there's always that moment in sort of satirical comedy, which have elements of drama, where you have a moment where the main character or someone speaks up, and all the fun and all the laughter just dies down. And for a very short period of time, there's something very genuine and heartfelt that comes through, and it's all the more poignant. And I really, really like series like that. I really, really do like comedy and satire that employs that technique.
Yeah, it's a way of making less palatable truths more something you can swallow, I think. To finish off, can we just have a little chat about Archer? Because I think that is an excellent example of it's not just parody. It obviously parodies things like James Bond and the whole spy movie type era, and it pokes fun. I think it pokes fun equally at sexism and at, you know, the more extreme strident forms of feminism and race and issues like that. And
I mean it pokes fun at quite a fair bit, like also the way that people act in general, like just small jokes in the first series where you see in films where people do dramatic things like toss food out of someone else's hand, you know, just over turn over a plate, and Archer constantly satirizing that with like, do you want ants, because this is how we get ants. it's very satirical, and it's a lot of parody in there.
It's extremely clever, and it's the fact that they haven't tried to make the main character Archer anything less than a womanizing, slightly misogynistic, full of himself, arrogant git, and yet at the same time he's this borderline sociopathic character. But he'll suddenly come out with things like, you know, Lana will say something she thinks has gone totally over his head, and they'll be in the middle of a gunfight, and he'll suddenly say, yes, I know what Animal Farm is. It is a 1960s novella written by George Orwell, etc., etc. And it turns out he's got depths. They play it up and play it up, so you're thinking, oh, Archer, you're such a card, but you're a real git. And then suddenly he'll turn around and it's like, oh my god.
I like the idea that, Archer has depths. He just chooses not to...
chooses not to use them.
Chooses not to use them. But every now and again, he does. He suddenly shows his very decent side, and you're like, damn it, Archer.
It's like, you're kind of in his colleague Lana's camp, because as a, you know, black or mixed race female agent who is just, in fact you could say she's more competent than Archer, she has less flashes of recklessness, but she probably gets more stuff done, and yet she's overlooked still because of it. She's overlooked for advancement and things like that, even though she probably is the more reliable, the better agent. And yet there are times when you think, actually, Lana's gone a bit too far off in that direction. And they'll poke fun at her. Nothing is off the table for anyone.
No.
And it has the most competent and well-rounded cast of female characters, as well as the male characters. I mean, some of them really are parodies, like, of archetypes. Krieger, for example, of the mad German doctor.
Krieger is so funny. Sorry.
Have you seen the most recent series?
No.
Krieger's new form. You have to check that out.
Okay, all right.
Because Archer has now got to the point where it could become basically a parody of itself, but they've decided not to do that. They've completely broken bounds and started exploring new genres with it, and it so totally works. It's bizarre. It's very, very clever.
I know we said the last thing we were going to talk about was Archer, but there is actually there's a book that I want to talk about. And this is very weird, because you're talking about a TV series and I'm talking about a book.
Reversal!
Gasp! We're parodies of ourselves. We're satirizing ourselves. I've been reading The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness.
Yep.
And basically, there's background parody constantly of all of the YA series. I mean, the whole premise is that in this town you have the indie kids. They're called the indie kids, and the indie kids always have to deal with the weird supernatural shit that happens.
Okay.
And so, like, for instance, they're like, oh yeah, so like about sort of 5 years ago we had the vampires and the school got blown up, and like before that it was the soul-eating ghosts, one of the characters' great grandfather around his time, it was the gods who attacked, and the indie kids just constantly had to take care of it, and the death rate of the indie kids is very, very high. And every now and again bad things happen, and the main characters of this series are not indie kids, they're just regular kids, and like they try and talk to the indie kids and they're like, can you tell us what's going on with the indie kids, and no, you wouldn't understand. And they're like, okay. And the indie kids all have really particular names. Like, there are four of the indie kids called Finn. And it's obviously taking the mick out of Twilight, all of the, you know, the Mortal Instruments. It's definitely taking the mick out of all of those. But the funny thing is that what's happening with the indie kids is always kind of in the background. at the start of every chapter, there's just a little summary of what's happening with the indie kids. And then it just goes back to the main characters going through the rest of their lives whilst the indie kids try and fight this evil in the background. So, for instance, the first opening line with a little summary for the indie kid is chapter the first, in which the messenger of the immortals arrives in a surprising shape, looking for a permanent vessel, and after being chased by her through the woods, indie kid Finn meets his final fate. And it just goes on, and like... Chapter the second, in which indie kid Satchel writes a poem and her mum and dad give her loving space to feel just what she needs to. Then an indie kid called Dylan arrives at her house, terrified, to say a mysterious glowing girl has informed him of the death of indie kid Finn. Satchel and Dylan comfort each other, platonically. And it just it continues like that. And there's this romance happening with the indie kids, like they keep kissing each other and stuff like that. We never actually meet them within the body of the book. It's all happening in the background. And it's really, really well done. And I love the way that this is satirized. But I think one of my favorite kids is bits is when the indie kids keep dying in this book. They just keep appearing dead in the background. One of the main characters, Mel, just goes, God, this is worse than that time than when all the indie kids were dying of cancer beautifully.
Oh my God, ouch.
It's really funny. It's a very odd book because on the one sense, it's very real and it's dealing with these kids. The main characters, one of them did have an anorexia, and another one is obsessive compulsive, and so you have these characters who are very interesting and very different, and dealing with, you know, the typical kind of YA kind of thing of I'm in love with you and one of them's gay, and you know, you've got all those kinds of things, and then there's this weird little supernatural stuff that's happening in the background at the same time. Like deer getting possessed and coming back from the dead, and these immortals and these flashing lights and the police all being taken over, and it's all happening in the background so far. None of it has really come into the main plot, and I just really, really like that because it's the first time, because you always do wonder whenever these amazing YA books come out, and it's like and these small group of friends have to save the world, and like, what's happening to the rest of the school? What do they think is happening right now?
Yeah.
So that's actually a really, really, because usually when YA is parodied, it's actually usually making fun of young adults, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And it's one of the issues I have with parody, is that parody, you see a lot of parody done of things which young teenage girls enjoy.
Yeah, and there are a group of people who actually don't need to be told that their interests are small and silly and, you know, not very relevant.
Yeah. And the reason I particularly like this book is that you do have... The tropes that you get in YA fantasy are being laughed at in this book, but at the same time, the book itself is still following some of the tropes and archetypes that one would expect in YA, which means that you do still have the romance, you do still have that uncertainty, you do still have that, oh God, what am I going to do with my life after all this is done? And so it's quite nice because it's making fun of the extra things you have in YA without making fun of the audience of YA. And for me, that's parody done right. Because recently, Rowan Atkinson came forward and said something which I'm a little bit upset about, but do you remember when Boris Johnson made that comment that women in burqa look like letterboxes?
Yes.
And Rowan Atkinson came forward and said, we shouldn't all be getting angry. No one is above humour. No one should be above humour. We should be able to, you know, poke fun at everything. And on the one side, I believe he has a point. I believe in poking fun at the Catholic Church, for instance. I do it all the time. And I believe in poking fun at institutions and bodies of power. But on the other side of it, I don't think that if humor comes at the cost of somebody's safety, at the cost of somebody's security, or if humor comes at the cost of somebody, it's not worth it.
No, it should generally, in most cases, except in exceptional circumstances, it should punch up. You shouldn't be punching down. You shouldn't be using people who are already silenced or not given much of a voice or insecure and, unsafe for whatever reason, to fuel your humour. And I know there is a, nobody should be above being mocked. And I generally agree, but I think there are some cases where you have to think, are you actually adding anything here? Because particularly stand-up comedians, you if you've become at all successful, you've actually got yourself to a place where you have some power and you can make differences and you can change things. So be careful how you wield that power, basically.
It's as you say. No, I do believe no one should be above being mocked, but at the same time, you've got to ask yourself, what is the price of that humour? What are you inflicting? And parody can be very bad for that because people can hide behind parody and just say, oh, it's just a joke, it's just a parody, and actually do some damage, which is why it's actually quite a dangerous form of humor as well as a popular one. So I get a little bit nervous whenever I see parody because I just think, who are you mocking here? Who's actually the punchline at the end of this? Who's the one who walks away, who has to walk away with the wound? And is it someone who can actually afford to walk away with that wound?
Yeah, I totally agree. As a complete aside, I'm just going to mention Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, old Maggie's coming into the conversation.
this is obviously I grew up with Margaret, and not literally with Margaret Thatcher, but she was very much a presence in my childhood.
Just hanging around your house.
Yeah, totally. No, but it did feel like that actually. And a topic for another time. But anyway. It would be almost impossible now in the days of the internet to hide from mockery. So you can be a political figure. It would be really difficult to hide from being mocked, to being satirized nowadays because, the internet disseminates information. Back in the 80s, back in, yeah, I've got my back in the 80s one in.
Back in my day.
Back in my day, back in my childhood, it would have been much harder. We didn't have the internet, and that's probably unconscionable for some people, but we just didn't have it. Margaret Thatcher's press team were exceptional at keeping her from hearing or seeing things that would offend her. And best remembered lines about her was the lips of Marilyn Monroe under the eyes of Caligula, which actually is a painful but kind of accurate portrayal of what she was like. She very much did use her sexuality to advance herself. And anyone who says, oh, she did great things for women. No, she did great things for Margaret Thatcher. She was a great woman, but she wasn't doing great things for women or the female cause. So please don't confuse those two things. No, where it sort of makes me laugh and also wince a little bit is when she came to the end of her tenure, finally, a reporter got the chance somewhat, to interview her through radio interview and she literally quoted this to Margaret Thatcher, the lips of Marilyn Monroe and the eyes of Caligula. How did you manage to do everything in your office while people were saying things like this and making comments on your legs, et cetera, and the spitting image parodies of you, which show you going into a man's toilets and standing at urinal to piss, kind of thing. And apparently, the other end of the phone line, where Margaret Thatcher would be answering, went absolutely icy silent, and the reporter realised her gaffe and the fact that Margaret Thatcher knew none of this because all this satire and all this parody had missed her entirely. Her press team had been exceptionally good at keeping it from her. Now, you can't do that these days. I very much doubt that Donald Trump doesn't know what's said about him, doesn't know that there are memes of his hair running wild in the rainforest, for
He's,
which is still
he is
hilarious.
constantly taking he is constantly taking issue with SNL, that's for sure.
The note I'm ending on here is that, yes, I think a lot of this satire is necessary because we'd go insane without it. But are we prodding someone who would be dangerous anyway to, because of his stupidity, to be more dangerous? to make more rash and foolish decisions because there is no way to hide from this kind of mockery anymore. Just a thought, really.
And on that very nervous...
Cheerful note.
It's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week.
Yep.
And I'm going to go ahead and recommend Upstart Crow as a TV series. It's not speculative fiction, but it definitely has elements of magic realism in the fact that you can have characters literally look straight into the camera and begin monologuing, which is not particularly realistic. So that's how I'm going to...
You don't do that in everyday life.
You don't do that in everyday life. And there actually have been witches who've appeared in the series and also fairies. So there we go. I'm standing by it.
You snuck that in there.
Snuck that in there. Fairies. Yes. In the last few seconds, I got the word fairy. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.